The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Despite a steep sell-off on Monday sparked by fears of a default by developer China Evergrande, the markets recovered to eke out small gains for the week. Nike was the biggest drag on the Dow and S&P. The sportswear maker's shares dropped more than 6%. Nike warned of delays during the holiday shopping season, blaming a supply chain crunch.
The Chinese government further tightened the screws on Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies on Friday, vowing to root out what it called, quote, illegal activity.
We're in a situation in which in normal times we're not reducing debts and deficits, while whenever there is a crisis, then we have to backstop the financial system. So we are in a debt super cycle where both in good times and in bad times, debt ratios are rising, and therefore eventually central banks are in a trap. People said they're going to normalize policy rates, but with these levels of private and public debt, if they were trying to do that, there'd be a market crash, an economic crash, and therefore I think the path of least resistance is going to be to wipe out the real value of nominal debt at fixed interest rates with higher inflation.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, it was another rough week for investors as markets get whipsawed by fears that possible collapse of Evergrande could spill over into the global economy at a time economies are still reeling from the coronavirus. Despite the pullback, investors stepped in and bought stocks. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. Ari sees commodities heading higher as they reverse their long-term downtrend. And later on, Tim Dewey joins me, the prominent economist and top Fed watcher, sees no interest rate hikes coming from the Fed until the end of next year. Tim sees no recession this year or in 2022. Later on, Chris Sheridan and I will tackle taxes, inflation, and bad legislation in the big picture. But before we do, let's find out the news driving the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
The two main catalysts this week driving the financial markets were reports of Evergrande on the brink of defaulting on its debt Monday, as well as the policy statement and conference call from the Federal Reserve on Wednesday. There were some other technical events that triggered as a result of these two major events, which I can briefly review as well. Let's start off with Evergrande, which is the second largest property developer in China by sales, with about 1,300 projects in more than 280 cities across China. The company has been pretty aggressive with its investments, currently building a $1.7 billion soccer stadium in the shape of a lotus flower. It looks beautiful, in addition to the theme park expected to open at the end of 2021. Now, its debt problems have been mounting, with over $300 billion worth of liabilities, and as recently as this Thursday, has failed to pay $84 million of interest that was due investors. There is a grace period of 30 days on that interest payment, but it also has another payment for another bond due next week. Over the last few weeks, the company has been warning investors it's having cash flow issues and having trouble finding buyers for its electric vehicle and property service business, as well as its Hong Kong office tower, which it bought for $1.6 billion in 2015. The stock has lost 85% of its value this year, and Fitch and Moody's have downgraded its credit rating. The concern is that Evergrande's debt problems could reverberate through the financial system and erode confidence. The Hang Seng Index dropped 3.3% on Monday, which sent the message abroad to de-risk across the globe. The S&P 500 fell 3% on Monday near the session lows, but buyers stepped in to help close the index only down 1.7%. The S&P 500 finally broke that 50-day moving average on the drop on Monday, and the volatility index, also known as the fear index, almost hit 29 before settling above 25 on that day. But by the end of this week, settled down right around 18. There were many strategists this week who expressed their views. Rick Rieder, the chief investment officer of Global Fixed Income at BlackRock, said, "My sense is the government will act, and my sense is it will stabilize." Morgan Stanley's global director of fixed income research said market concerns over Evergrande's liquidity crisis spilling to China's financial markets may be overdone. And Fed Chairman Jerome Powell also weighed in on Evergrande to say it's a China-specific issue. Seeming to confirm Rick Reeder's comments, the People's Bank of China did react this week by injecting 460 billion yuan through the week and another tranche of 70 billion yuan on Friday. Now, the other major news event this week was the Fed's policy statement on Tuesday. The Fed left the target range for the Fed funds rate unchanged as expected. Regarding its asset purchase program, the statement suggested tapering its program may soon be warranted. And Powell clarified during the conference, suggested specifically, if the September jobs report is decent, it would be enough to start tapering in November, with the program to wrap up by the middle of next year. So data dependent there, and the jobs will be announced not next Friday, which is the 1st of October, but on the 8th, the following week. In another less dovish move, the Fed's median estimate for its first interest rate hike was moved up on the timetable from no change through 2022 to a hike in 2022. If they wait for the closeout of their asset purchases, a rate hike could come as early as the third quarter of 2022, based on Powell's comments this week regarding the timeline for concluding a taper mid-2022. Interest rates for the 10-year Treasury were all over the map this week, down heavy on contagion fears over Evergrande on Monday, and then spiking on Thursday and Friday to near-term highs. The 10-year Treasury yield closed at 1.3% last Friday and settled, last I checked, around 1.46% on Friday, up 16 basis points for the week, so a very big push higher. The rise in rates has lifted the financial sector of stocks late this week and has caused any rally in high-growth stocks to be somewhat tame after that correction on Monday. Focus on Evergrande's debt issues Monday and the Fed's policy statement Wednesday were the two biggest drivers this week. Some of the company news items we received this week were earnings from FedEx as well as Nike, among many others, but I wanted to highlight these two because it really points towards the supply chain issues that many companies are facing. Now, FedEx missed earnings and said its costs have risen $450 million year over year on constraints in the labor market. They're having to pay more for labor. Minimum wage is not cutting it anymore. I remember reading a story they told about their Oregon hub was operating around, I think, 65% of staffing needed, and they've rerouted much of its deliveries there to longer routes and increased their costs because of it, and increased the time it's taken for those packages and shipments. Across the network, more than 600,000 packages are being rerouted, they've said. But the good news is they have more than a dozen automated facilities coming online slated for this fall to help. Demand isn't their issue, it's labor. I hear that a lot from a lot of the business clients I deal with, so no surprise there. And then Nike, similar issues, but more related to COVID than labor issues, in particular to costs. With Vietnam shut down, Nike has lost 10 weeks of production due to factory shutdowns there and also in Indonesia earlier the quarter. Nike beat consensus on earnings but missed on revenues and guided its fiscal year 2022 revenues down to mid-single-digit growth. Supply chain woes abound. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. I'll be focusing again on economic reports over the next 2 weeks where we'll get some really important data, especially some that could play into the Fed's decision to begin a taper very soon.
Evergrande is the unavoidable conclusion to unsustainable Chinese growth policies. So says Gordon Chang, who we spoke with on FS Insider this week. Here's a clip of what he told listeners.
Evergrande is the logical conclusion of the policies that Beijing has been adopting and implementing for quite some time. But they can do this because they've got high currency walls. So you can do pretty much whatever you want inside your country. And that had a big advantage in 2008 because it permitted China to avoid the problems we saw elsewhere. But what happened, though, as leaders realized they could do what they want, they continued policies which were uneconomic and unsustainable. But now I think we could very well be seeing a resolution of this.
Gordon also goes on to explain how Evergrande is not the only property developer facing problems in China and how he thinks this is likely to play out. To listen to this full 15-minute interview with Gordon Chang, author of The Great U.S.-China Tech War, where we also touch on a wide range of issues facing the world's second largest economy, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the program is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. You and I were talking just before we went on the air that since the recovery from the March lows, we haven't had anything like a 10% correction in a market. So this, you know, we were due for one, were we not?
We were due for one. It has been, I think that's what's most surprising, that it was such an extended amount of time since we've had some market volatility, which, as we know, is a reoccurring theme when you deal with the markets. I believe October 2020 was the last time we had a 5% pullback on a closing basis.
I want to talk about the S&P this year. I think it was up before the pullback somewhere around 20%. But Ari, as you look underneath the surface within the S&P, you got two stocks. I think it was Apple and Microsoft that accounted for 30% of the S&P's gains. If you take the four stocks, add in Google and Tesla, you're almost 49%. So you've had a handful of stocks that have been driving this, but underneath the surface, a lot of stocks are down or flat for the year.
That's right. That, you know, here we're talking about as if market volatility just started in recent weeks, when for the average investor, or for the average stock, I should say, it's really been going on for a number of months now. That, you know, one market issue had been that small cap weakness, and using the Russell 2000 as a benchmark, was really playing out throughout the summer. The Russell has been in a range really since the first quarter of this year. That weakness hadn't spilled over into the large cap benchmark. So this is now changing. And what this internal correction has done with, you know, the average stock, forget the exact performance you gave regarding their year-to-date performance, but the fact that it hasn't been as strong as the Apples and Microsofts, through that, our tactical indicators have reset. We have the Investors Intelligence Bull Bear Ratio, which is a contrarian measure of investor sentiment, has fallen to 2.2 from 4.0, which now marks the least optimism in the poll since May 2020. The percentage of NYSE stocks above their 200-day average has fallen to 50% from 89% to start the year. Again, the lowest tally since November of 2020. So we see this all as indications of being bull market oversold. And for the S&P 500, there's also support at 4230, you know, marking the July low, the May peak, and the minimum retracement of the rally since Q4 20.
Let's talk about something else that we've seen, and that is this pullback on what I call the reflation trade. You've seen a pullback in copper. We saw a brief pullback in oil. We've seen a pullback in gold and silver. How much of this has to do with, let's say, money being diverted into cryptos?
That's plausible. I don't have any indicators I can point to specifically to support that. What I can point to is that a lot of that weakness that we've seen in the reflationary themes in commodity prices as well has coincided with a rally in the U.S. dollar that started this summer. Kind of more broadly speaking, our checks indicate that inflation has likely peaked for the cycle. We've argued that stability in the greenback should help limit consumer pricing pressure. And so far, we've seen a rally in the dollar coincide with a downtick in inflation expectations. So in terms of equities, we've seen the reflationary themes, the value-related ideas come under pressure. They've been disturbed over the near term. We don't think they're broken. Instead, we think it's given investors the green light to get back into growth stocks. And we do, you know, thinking a bit more longer term, expect this more Goldilocks scenario to prove positive for both the value ideas as well as the long-term equity cycle.
So as you look at this market, you see this as a normal corrective cycle in a long-term bull market?
Yeah, this could potentially be the often discussed mid-cycle correction. I think that's the more important point, is that we're thinking in terms of this as a mid-cycle opportunity. Now, taking a step back, we think the bull market that started in March 2020 is 1.5 years into what is typically closer to a 2.5 to 3 year bull market. So we think there's another year to this. And we'd argue that our longer term indicators are confirming this roadmap too. Now, market participation is coming off its highest reading since 2009, which is really something to say. And so using past analogs like 2004 and 2010, it's likely that the pace of the advance should slow from the fast rise that the equity market has already enjoyed over the last year. But we think the gains should continue nonetheless.
What about what's going on with the small cap? We're seeing some weakness there. Does that concern you?
The weakness in the Russell 2000 gauges small cap stocks is perhaps most troubling in our work, but we'd also argue that it cuts both ways. Now, our work indicates breakdowns in the Russell have been tremendous opportunities to buy stocks broadly. However, it can be tough to differentiate how bad small caps have to get before that opportunity is presented. So take, for instance, the Russell 2000 now finally starting to dip below its 200-day. You know, is that enough to mark a washout? Or can we see a scenario where it has to get ugly first, where the Russell 2000 falls below the neckline of its top that it's been in over the last 6 months at around 2100? I could almost see in that being a buying opportunity rather than a selling opportunity, where the index could fall below there, but then due to its mean reverting quality, snap right back and be the catalyst for a resumption of this mid-cycle bull market.
Let's move over to the side of interest rates. What is remarkable about what we're seeing with interest rates, inflation is running, at least lately, it's been around 5%, and yet we're seeing bond yields at 1.3%.
I think that speaks to the anchor that are on U.S. rates from even lower rates overseas. You know, how high can the U.S. 10-year get when over 20% of the world's debt remains in negative territory? So that speaks to the range-bound environment that we're expecting for interest rates over the coming months to even the coming quarters. But from a trading basis, we think the 10-year is stabilizing. We think it's positioned to break above resistance at 1.37% and work its way back to the upper end of its range at around 1.75%. I expect that to be a positive for some of the interest rate sensitive sectors, as well as a net positive for the S&P 500 overall.
So let's move and talk about the Fed. The Fed is meeting. A lot of talk is that they will begin taper. Maybe it'll be a small amount of taper, $10, $15 billion a month. What's your views on the Fed? Do they actually go through completely with taper and eliminate QE and then start raising interest rates? I don't know if they're going to get that far. At least that's my opinion. But what's yours?
I don't have a strong view on when or if the Fed starts to taper or how significant it's going to be. But let's assume taper equates to the first rate hike in prior cycles and think in terms of what the implications would be for the equity market. You know, generally, while there are occurrences of near-term volatility when the Fed starts to change course in terms of monetary policy, overall S&P returns remain above average over the next 6 to 12 months after the hike, indicating you want to buy that volatility. So overall, we found that bull markets don't peak in anticipation of tighter monetary policy. They peak when tighter policy restricts credit to the point of recession, and we don't see the evidence for this.
So given where we are right now, we've had roughly about a 5% pullback. We're rallying on the day you and I are speaking. What are the chances, if you were to put money to work right now, do you think you would be a little bit more cautious and wait for this thing to play out? Or do you think there's good opportunities right now with this pullback?
I think it's too difficult to time the near-term ebbs and flows of the market. very often the saying goes, you get the bang and then the whimper. I think this was the bang. If you look at volatility measures like the VIX, you had a pretty significant spike in it. There are, then there's the duration aspect of it. At times there can be a test of that low or even a lower low. Usually you'll see lesser in selling intensity at that point with a lower VIX reading, fewer stocks falling to a new low. You know, that's the near-term base that's that gets carved out. But more importantly, I think as the market comes in here, these are the chances to put new money to work. I think high earnings growth is an attractive core position due to its ability to withstand the fluctuations in the rate and commodity market. So investors can start there. You know, we get it. Tech won't be the top performer when rates are swinging higher and the market is embracing beta. But we do expect the sector to produce some of the steadier returns through the course of the cycle.
In terms of commodities, what's your view on oil?
We're still going by the viewpoint that commodity prices have reversed higher. I think, broadly speaking, that the 10-year decline that they've been in has reversed to the upside, that oil prices, industrial metals should continue to make higher highs. I think a stable dollar indicates it's going to be a steadier ascent to that move. There's going to be some up backing and filling along the way. But for the price of West Texas, I think you're, as long as you're above the 200-day average, which is currently at around $63, I think crude oil breaks to the upside and you get that new high above $77. The energy sector really has been a beta trade. It's an area of the market that can move a lot in a short amount of time. I think you do want to keep your stops close in that sector, but we do recommend a market weight positioning, and there are some stocks within that sector we like more than others. You know, one standout showing relative strength, is ConocoPhillips. I think really is best of that group.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, as we close, if people like to follow your work at Oppenheimer, tell them how they can do so, please.
Well, they can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wald.
Well, Ari, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Have a great fall and the rest of the year.
Adam Rosenzweig, the well-known commodity strategist at Gehring and Rosenzweig, gave listeners an update this week on the commodity space now that we've seen a strong post-COVID rally. Adam explains how much commodities are still undervalued relative to financial assets and also presents his outlook on oil, gas, uranium, and the ag sector. Here's a clip of what he told FS Insider listeners this week.
Where do things stand now that commodities have had a move? And I think the answer, and it surprises a lot of people, is that you need a magnifying glass to see where commodities are sort of off their bottom. And what I mean by that, you know, what we like to look at the ratio of the commodity price index to financial assets. And what we saw is that going all the way back to 1900, as you mentioned, you know, resources never had been cheaper. And this was in 2018, 2019, and obviously with the massive bottom process that happened during COVID in 2020. And now when you look at things today, yeah, it's not as cheap as it was a year ago, but people ask us all the time, it's like, you know, can you update the chart? And we say, guys, it is updated. You just can't see the move off the bottom. That's how undervalued things were. And to put it in perspective, you know, if you're talking about something that's 95th percentile, 100th percentile of undervaluation, or something that's fallen 80+% and it doubles, you know, you're still talking about something that's off 65-70% from the old highs, right? So you have a huge amount of runway out in front of you. What's different is now I think that some investors have become slightly less bearish on the margin, but we have not seen any big money flow into the space. And so I think it has a long way to run.
This is definitely one interview you won't want to miss. To access this and all of our premium content airing 3 days during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, lately, Wall Street has been downgrading economic growth. The Fed is talking about taper. Where is this all leading? Is a recession in the cards, or do we continue to grow? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Professor Tim Dewey. He's Senior Director of the Oregon Economic Forum. He's also a professor of economics at the University of Oregon and Chief U.S. Economist for SGH Macro. Tim, last year you were calling for strong economic growth, which has played out. Now the economy is starting to slow down. You still hold that view, or has it changed?
I still hold that view. I don't think there's a question that the economy was going to slow down this year, given that we had some pretty sharp rebounds earlier this year. And those rebounds obviously weren't going to be sustainable. So there's no question that really growth had to mechanically slow. It's sort of an issue of, does it slow from, you know, 6-7% to 5% or 4%? Well, 4% would still be very, very quick growth. So I don't think this, the growth slowdown is like, you know, what we've seen in previous sorts of cycles where we're talking about going from, you know, 3% to 1% or less. This is we're going from super hot to something that's not quite so hot.
Tim, I know you are considered one of the top commentators on the Fed. The Fed has been talking about taper. Give me your latest view of what you think the Fed is thinking at this time.
Yeah, right now, I think the Fed is circling around tapering asset purchases this year. I think they're likely to do that at the November meeting, unless there's some dramatic change in financial markets or the economy between now and then. So I expect that we're going to see a Fed taper not until later this year.
Now, in the past, I know that beginning with Yellen and Powell, they tried to raise the Fed funds rate. I think they got to 2.5%. And then quickly had to turn around and reduce it, even though we were in an economic recovery. Given the level of debt that we are taking on, both at the federal level, corporate debt, consumer debt, will the Fed be able to raise interest rates, or do you think they're going to have to do it just simply with taper?
I think, you know, we're way off from an interest rate hike. I mean, at best, we probably are not going to see an interest rate hike until the end of next year. But on the good question, I mean, it was a really good question of how, what's the terminal rate on any hike cycle going to be? The Fed currently believes that the terminal rate on a hike cycle is on average about 2.5%. I'm cautious about that. I tend to think that, we've been in a long downward channel, trend of lower and lower interest rates. And I haven't seen anything yet that would suggest to me that we're breaking out of that trend. So my guess is that when the Fed does start moving, they're going to proceed cautiously because they don't want to risk slamming the brakes on the economy too quickly, just simply because they know that that upper limit might not be as high as certainly, or they don't believe it's as high as when they started hiking interest rates in the last cycle.
So right now, you've got some bills working their way through Congress. One would be a very large tax increase with this budget reconciliation bill. What do you think would be the impact of not only higher taxes, but also Fed tapering and maybe tightening?
I would think of it this way. It's not just the higher taxes and the tapering. The higher taxes are intended to support additional spending as well. So there's a demand side impulse from the spending. And the argument's going to be there's also going to be a supply side impulse from infrastructure spending. And then there'll be sort of a demand side pullback from tax hikes. The net effect, I think, will be on net stimulative, as long as we're still increasing the budget deficit as a result. But I think you've actually hit upon another point. Is when people talk about the infrastructure package, the Democrats' spending plans, You know, they really should be thinking those net of taxes, and that will diminish some of the fiscal impulse from those. I think the tapering. I think there's a good case to be made that the asset purchases right now are not adding a lot to the economy. And really what challenges there are in the economy that have actually exacerbated so the growth slowdown we talked about earlier are really supply side constraints, is that, you know, we can't, no matter what the level of asset purchases are, that's not really affecting the supply of computer chips that are, you know, hobbling the auto industry, for example. So I'm not terribly concerned that drawing back on asset purchases is going to, you know, be something that derails the economy. And similar for tax cuts that are, or excuse me, tax hikes that are sort of balanced with more spending. I think really what's going to be driving your impetus of the economy going forward here is how fast we can go jobs and what wage growth is.
So when you take a look at those things, I think I read there was like 10,000 or 10 million job openings and, what, 8 million people unemployed or more. What impact do you think it will have now that I guess the extra unemployment benefits are expiring without making it easier for employers to find work? Because we keep reading stories in the Wall Street Journal. I see it here locally with restaurants. McDonald's are given incentives to hire people. What about the impact of government policy on, let's say, hiring?
This has been the one of the holdups, you know, in the labor market that we don't entirely know what's going on yet, is why labor supply has not really bounced back as aggressively as we were hoping earlier this year. Clearly, we have a record number of job openings in the economy as measured by the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, the JOLTS report. In fact, we have more jobs open than we have number of people claiming to be unemployed. And that was what the situation was pre-pandemic as well. So in that sense, we're kind of at some kind of a pre-pandemic labor market potentially, but at a very lower level of jobs. We thought that, you know, jobs, labor supply would come back quickly, and it hasn't. And it hasn't yet, even with the end of these enhanced unemployment insurance benefits. Now, I'm a little bit cautious in reading too much into the early data there. It's probably going to take some time. If unemployment insurance was a large impact, it would take some time, I think, before we can expect that that would have a better impact, a bigger impact on the on job growth, but there could be some other deeper structural issues going on in the labor market that we don't completely understand right now, and those might be people have talked about childcare issues with COVID, some ongoing COVID hesitancy, an accelerated pace of retirements, or older persons not re-entering the labor force as they normally would. Just general COVID hesitancy. Maybe I already said that one. all sort of combining in such a way that people have stepped back from the labor market, and the supply response will not be as quick as we had hoped for, and as a result, we'd actually see, you know, considerably more upward pressure on wages for a longer period of time than maybe we thought 3 or 6 months ago.
I want to talk about, they're talking about the debt ceiling, and of course, some of these spending packages, whether it's the infrastructure bill or the budget reconciliation bill, are talking about massive amounts of spending. People have always thought that adding all this debt would slow down the economy or it'd have an impact on the economy. When is debt too much debt, given the size of the U.S. economy? In other words, you take a look at Japan's debt to GDP ratio is higher than ours. So could we go much higher without any ill effects to the economy?
Yes, this is a great, you know, this is a great issue, is that, you know, we don't really know what the upper limit is for debt, particularly in an economy like ours, where we can, you know, really print the money to support that debt should it become absolutely necessary. What we're looking for is sort of a signal of what the upper side of our debt carrying capacity would be. I think would be less financial and more real. To the extent that, you know, I'd be much more concerned about the scope of debt issuance if we were facing some kind of inflationary pressures within the United States. So if we do start to face those kinds of inflationary pressures, that would be a concern for me that perhaps we had overspent and had interest rates that were too low, and that we would need to rebalance macroeconomic policy to guide inflation back lower. But we so far, I would say, have not we have not experienced some kind of a typical, you know, adverse event from excessive debt issuance that people have talked about. I think primarily people would worry about higher interest rates. But again, as far as we can tell, that long downward channel of interest rates has just not been broken. There's actually considerable demand for safe assets from a number of sources. You know, for example, certainly pension funds or other asset managers are huge demanders of U.S. debt. People really want to add this product to their portfolio. So until we see, you know, I think some real economic constraints, on the real side of the economy, and that, you know, we just are running inflation, you know, 3-4%. I'm hard pressed to say that we need some sharp turn in macro policy just yet.
So, you've been mentioning inflation. What's your view? The Fed's view is that the inflation that we've seen recently is transitory. Others would argue that it's more longer term. What's your view?
So my view is that it's largely transitory. I don't really know that anyone seriously believes that the sort of 8% annualized rates that we had earlier this year represent what inflation is going to be like going forward. So it's clear that there are some fairly significant pandemic related events in you know, leisure and hospitality, you know, generally, but say shelter costs with lodging away from home that you know, where we saw very sharp upward changes in prices. We also saw some upward changes in particularly used vehicle prices related to just a shortage of new vehicles. So clearly those things are there in the data, but they're not likely to be continued going forward. Now, that said, I do think that there's some more persistent elements of the inflationary pressure going forward, where we see these supply chain constraints maybe extending into the middle of next year. And we see these very tight labor markets and a lot of unknowns about when those labor markets would actually be, would get some relief. So my view has been that we're going to see some elevated inflation over the next year, somewhere, you know, around 2.3, maybe 2.4%. So we get a little bit of elevated inflation in 2022, but certainly, you know, still much of the inflation that we saw this year will turn out to be transitory. One thing we should be watching is how inflation expectations move. Do inflation expectations continue to move higher, or do they firm in a range that would be consistent with what we think is the Fed's target of 2%? Right now, they have sort of rebounded into that range. I don't think the Fed wants to see inflation expectations, the survey measures, at least move dramatically higher from these levels.
You know, in the past, you know, a lot of the recessions were preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle and a rise in inflation. Given the level of debt that we now see both at all levels of society and our economy, I would think, Tim, that the Fed would be very cautious about how they proceed going forward, because the last thing they would want to do is throw this economy into a recession. Unemployment goes up, and then how do you fight your way out of that?
Right, and they do want to be cautious about how they proceed, and that's why again I don't think you'd see the Fed projecting a very steep or expecting a very steep path of rate hikes, you know, absent some real aggressive, absent some real strong economic conditions late next year and into the following year, because there's no question in my mind that the new framework that they have developed is intended to prevent them from erring on the side of recession. And so that's, I think, very keen on their mind that they do not want this economy to overheat in such a way that they would have to, you know, push unemployment higher. I think they'd rather sort of move gradually into a tighter monetary policy regime.
So given what you're seeing right now, even though Wall Street's downgrading to slower economic growth, you think that's sustainable and can go well into next year and beyond?
Oh yeah, I'm not worried about the general growth outlook or the for the U.S. economy. You know, I think that there's a lot of underlying momentum coming out of the private sector. Yeah, I think you get back to the very very significant job openings, and I think the fact that even if there's some slowdown, you know, some constraints on labor supply that we would like to be alleviated first, more quickly, there should be strong growth in employment and wages going forward that will really provide, I think, the backbone for spending going forward. Household balance sheets are in great positions. Household debt is very low. At least the cost of financing household debt is very low. People's balance sheets and wealth have been enhanced by, you know, higher asset prices like stocks and housing, and also a huge amount of savings that occurred during the pandemic. So households are doing well. Corporations are in general doing well, except I think you're seeing again their major challenges being getting supply chains up and running to meet demand right now, and then we'll hopefully spark some additional capital investment going into next year, which will also be a supportive of the economy. And finally, I sort of add that there's a long run demographic trend as the millennials are aging into their home buying and peak earning years that should be fairly supportive of growth as well.
Okay, so economic growth still on track. Professor, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Great information. Thanks for coming.
Today, we're going to continue with part two of our show from earlier this week, taxes, inflation, and bad legislation. But as we've been discussing and warning now for some time on our program, get prepared for higher taxes, higher inflation, and of course, bad legislation.
What is rather interesting, and I'm coming at this from a planning perspective, not only individuals, but also companies. But Chris, every single president since I began my career, which I, you know, got into this business in 1980, Ronald Reagan came in, he changed taxes in 81. He changed them again in 86. Then George Bush comes in. He changes taxes, raises them. He's followed by Bill Clinton, who raised taxes. And Clinton was followed by George W., who lowered them, followed by Obama, who raised them, followed by Trump, who lowered them. And now we have Biden, who's raising them. So it seems like, and this is one of the things that makes it more difficult as a business or individuals to plan, is every time you get a new president, they either raise taxes or lower taxes. So right now, Biden's in, and they got a probably, Chris, in nominal terms, it's probably the largest tax increase in U.S. history. If you're looking at it in real terms, in other words, adjusted for inflation, I think the figure is probably the highest taxes in 50 years. So I'm going to review this very quickly for our weekend listeners, and then we're going to talk about what's going on with inflation and how legislation is going to affect both inflation and taxes down the road, and also economic growth. But let's talk about something that's going on right now. They're proposing, and who knows how this is going to turn out. It's like a sausage factory. It's already, they've already modified what they want to do and gotten rid of some of the really bad, onerous estate taxes that would have crippled a lot of farms and businesses in this country. So let's begin. So right now, the top tax rate is 37%. The Biden bill would raise it back to where it was under Obama at 39.6. But that's not the whole story. It's the level at which you hit the higher tax brackets. So, for example, if you're married, you don't hit the 37% tax bracket until your income is $628,000. They would lower that from $628,000 to $450,000. So at $450,000, you would hit the 39.6% bracket if you're married. And if you're single, they would drop the bracket, which the highest rate kicks in, down to $400,000 from $523,000. So income tax rates are going up, and the level at which they assess those higher rates are being lowered so they can capture more of your income at lower levels with the higher tax bracket. On top of that, there's a 3% surtax on anybody making over $5 million. So, for example, if you live in my own state of California, that would be 44% with Obama tax. Add another 3% surtax, you're at 47. Add California's 13.3 state tax, you're at 60%. Then on top of that, they really go after small business. A lot of there's two kinds of corporations. You have C-Corps, where Trump in his tax bill lowered the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 21% to make us more competitive because the U.S. had the highest tax rates in the world. So for those that have sub-S corporations, what the government did or what the Trump tax bill did, you gave sub-S corporations a 20% deduction to kind of equalize what was happening with C-Corps. The Biden bill would get rid of the 20% deduction and add an additional 3.8% surtax on anything taken out. The way it works right now in a sub-S corp, you take out a salary. Let's say you pay yourself a salary of $100,000. You pay taxes on that $100,000. But let's say in your corporation, there's another $100,000 of profit in that corporation that you did not take out in a salary. You would simply pay, that would go into your tax return, taxed at your marginal tax rate. Well, what they would do now is they would simply get rid of the deductions and they would also pass this surtax added onto it. So it's really a huge tax increase against small businesses. Moving on quickly, the estate tax exemption right now is $11,700,000. They would drop it to $5.5 million. The latest version of the bill, they got rid of the deemed dispositions at death, and they got they were going to do away with the stepped-up basis in costs, which would allow the government to tax your estate twice. Corporate tax rates would go from 21% to 26.5%. The minimum foreign tax would go from 10.5% to 16.6%, and they would raise the capital gains tax from 20% to 25%, and then you add 3.8% for the Obamacare tax. So the top capital gains rate will be 28.8%. Now, one of the things that we were watching, Chris, was if you were going to raise prior to this anything over that, over a certain level of income, like if you make $1 million a year, you don't get capital gains, favorable capital gains. You don't get favorable taxation on dividends. You would be taxed as ordinary income. Well, one of the things that we were worried about is the masters of the universe that work on Wall Street, I'm talking about these billionaires that have made a fortune in this bull market, if you know that next year the tax rates were going to go to 44% from today's 23.8%, what would you be doing? You'd probably be selling your stocks at the end of the year. Well, in order to, they kind of saw this in advance. So in this bill, the capital gains rate would be effective to not this Monday, but the previous Monday. So they sort of heading that out the pass. If people are going to dump their stocks this year to avoid the higher tax rates, they're going to make this higher capital gains tax rate effective going back to the beginning of September. Now, minimum foreign taxes, I mentioned, would be 10.5. It would go to 16.6 and then the capital gains. So right now, we are raising taxes. These are massive tax increases. And one of the issues we're going to have to look at, the economy is slowing down. Third quarter GDP is slowing down. We'll have some something to say about that. Fourth quarter is downgraded. And the Fed is talking about taper. So we could be into an issue, Chris, next year. If this tax increases get passed, they get implemented, it's going to hit the economy. It's going to hit small businesses. At the same time, you've got higher inflation on the way, plus the Fed raising interest rates and cutting back liquidity. So this could have major impact on the economy in 2022.
Well, it sounds like in that case that we might be setting up for a stagflationary-like environment.
That's exactly it. And we'll have more to say about that. There was an investment conference this week. You had Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury under Bill Clinton, and then the Obama administration. He sees higher inflation rates. Nouriel Roubini sees stagflation. And we've covered this and written about it, but there are three larger macro things that are impacting the markets right now for inflation. One is demographics. We have an aging population, a shrinking workforce, reverse globalization. One of the things we're finding with the supply chain problems that we're having right now, everything was outsourced to China. What happens if China has problems? They're shutting down their ports because of COVID. The supply chain disruptions, everything from computer chips to, you know, I try to get a brand new printer, I can't get one. Household appliances, refrigerators. So supply chain problems. And then we also talked about oligopolies. More and more, you're seeing consolidation of every single industry. We've been doing research looking at drugstores. You're getting down to almost two drugstores now. You've got Walgreens, Boots, and then you have basically CVS. So as more and more industries consolidate, what that does, it gets rid of competition, gets better pricing power, higher profits for the company, but it is inflationary. Then on top of that, unlike the tech bursting of the tech bubble where the Fed came in and lowered interest rates, the financial crisis where they lowered interest rates, we never saw big levels or high levels of inflation. What's different now is the government is actually putting money into people's pocketbooks. They're cutting checks, whether it's supplemental unemployment checks, if it's supplemental checks that they sent out. I mean, we've spent already $3.6 trillion of stimulus between Trump and Biden. Biden passed the $1.9 trillion stimulus at the beginning of the year. And right now, they're on Capitol Hill debating on a $3.5 trillion stimulus, or what they call the Green New Deal program, plus $1.2 trillion for infrastructure. So a total stimulus this year, if all gets passed, of $6.5 trillion on top of a $6 trillion government budget. So you almost have government spending, increased spending, that's going to be almost 30% of GDP. So all of that is creating inflation because unlike the financial crisis where most of the money the Fed printed stayed on the bank's balance sheet or on the Fed's balance sheet, it wasn't being pushed into the economy in the form of loans and credit, which is one reason we didn't get inflation. The other thing, too, is we're seeing now is unemployment benefits are driving labor costs. I mean, look at it this way. With the government shutdowns, we literally put 300,000 businesses out of business. Then on top of that, with the we put nearly 2 million people out of work with those shutdowns. So you have 10 million job openings. You have 8.5 or close to 10 million people that are unemployed. They're not going to work because from their point of view, why would I want to go work for a minimum wage, 11, 12 bucks, depending on what state you're in, when I can get 15 to 18 bucks on unemployment? So it's driving up costs. So you're seeing it reflected in earnings. FedEx missed their earnings. They talked about shortage of labor. KB Homes missed their earnings. They talked about shortage of labor. So when the government is competing with the private sector with unemployment benefits, what's happening? Everywhere you look, companies are having to give out bonuses. They're raising wages and all that. Those wages are being reflected along with higher energy costs in everything that you see that you buy. Because how do you get goods to your house? How does Amazon deliver something to you? Well, they got trucks, they have vans, they're higher gas prices here in California. I just filled up my tank. I paid $4.89. We're on the way to $5. All of that's being pushed through, which it really brings me to the point of this conference where you had basically both Larry Summers, who says today there's just no way out other than inflation. And we're going to have to see 5%, 6%, and 8% inflation rates to basically make this debt more manageable. And then, of course, Nouriel Roubini is reflecting the point that you made, Chris, which is stagflation. Slowing economy, higher rates of inflation. And this week, the Fed met. They're talking about raising interest rates sooner because inflation is becoming more persistent than they thought. And that goes back to a lot of these macro things that we've been talking about. Demographics, globalization, and oligopolies are basically long-term macro things that are going to drive up the levels of inflation. Then add to that, government putting money into people's pockets. More money than goods raises the price of those goods.
You know, as we've been discussing, the Federal Reserve largely relies upon historical data and mathematical models for inflation. And as we all know, every one of those things that you just labeled, demographics, globalization, oligopolies, the supply chain disruptions, none of these fit into a mathematical model, right? I mean, demographics and what we see there, these are large macro developments, long-term, that, I mean, they take them into account, but it's not something that you can plug into a formula and predict. So they have a major blind spot. And I think more and more people are lining up to that. And now we're seeing the Fed catch up to the idea that inflation is remaining more persistent and sticky than what they originally anticipated, which is why they were more hawkish in this most recent statement. The dot plots are all ticking up, showing that more Fed governors are lining on the side of tapering and then raising interest rates sooner than expected. But again, supply chain disruptions now, they've become systemic in nature. They're affecting almost every part of the economy and not just an isolated assortment of goods. That's not something that they have in their mathematical models or supply chain disruptions. Oligopolies, like you said, massive industry concentration into a smaller and smaller number of companies. We see this in the market right now, as you've explained, we've discussed on our show, with index returns being driven by just four companies. I mean, if you look at just Microsoft and Google, like you discussed with Ari Walt today, you know, nearly a third of the S&P 500 now being driven by these two different companies. So industry concentration also. And when you factor in the fact that, you know, we had widespread lockdowns after COVID, which just killed small businesses, a lot of that extra supply of goods and services now has just been funneled into a very small number of companies, which were allowed to stay open. And small business sector can't bounce back really quick. So that's also inflation. All these things are just major blind spots for the Fed.
I want to quote from my favorite book, Dying of Money, Lessons of the Great German and American Inflations by Jenzo Parsons. That was the nom de plume. His real name is Ronald Marx. We did an interview with him. We actually discovered him, who he was, 3 or 4 years ago. But here's where we are right now. We are in what I call the good part of inflation. The economy's growing. The stock market is going up. And this is a quote from the book. Everyone loves an early inflation. The effects at the beginning of an inflation are all good. They're steep in money expansion, rising government spending, increased government budget deficits, booming stock markets, and spectacular general prosperity, all in the midst of a temporary stable prices. Everyone benefits, no one pays. And that's the early part of the cycle. And the latter inflation, on the other hand, the effects are all bad. The government may steadily increase the money inflation in order to stave off the latter effects, but the latter effects patiently wait. In the terminal inflation, there's faltering prosperity, tightness of money, falling stock prices, rising taxes, still larger government deficits, and still roaring money expansion. It's now accompanied by soaring prices and the ineffectiveness of all the traditional remedies. Everyone pays and no one benefits. And that's the full cycle of every inflation. And that's from Dying of Money. And so right now we are going through what we call the good effects of inflation, stock prices rising, the economy's growing. But in the end, there's a price to pay. And one of the biggest myths that is perpetuated by the media and government is free stuff. So if you look at the legislation, one of the problems that we're dealing with is what's going to happen to Social Security and Medicare, which were not being discussed. And we'll talk about that when we get to bad legislation. But right now, money's pouring into the economy. People are spending. The economy's still growing. And the stock market's going up. But remember, the market is being driven by a handful of stocks. Just five stocks or four stocks account for 49% of the S&P's gains.
So, Jim, we touched upon taxes today. Taxes are going up. Inflation is going up. Big blind spot for the consensus and most economists, including the Fed, when it comes to inflation, given these large macro factors that we've been discussing on our show and as we hit on today. So let's talk about the last part, which is bad legislation.
Well, the legislation is working its way through. At least the news today is they hope to vote on it next week. There's dissension among the Democrats in terms of the $3.5 trillion. Others want it bigger. There's dissension over the infrastructure. So who knows, Chris? This is kind of like it changes almost every single week. But the worst thing that you can do right now, the economy is slowing down. It's slowing down in the third quarter. It'll slow down even more in the fourth quarter. When you've got small businesses that are barely staying alive, an economy that's trying to recover, the last thing you want to hit it with is taxes and higher interest rates. So the Fed is talking about cutting back on taper. That's going to cause bond yields to rise. And eventually they're going to start raising interest rates. Obviously, that's going to affect the housing market. It's going to affect a lot of things. Then on top of that, you're adding all these taxes. So what is it going to be? $3.5 trillion in new taxes. So you're adding it at a time the economy's slowing down. Another mistake. The tax bill itself is really clobbering small business, which is struggling to stay afloat. I mean, they can't get workers. We have partial shutdowns. You've got things where businesses aren't allowed, like restaurants in LA can't see anybody that doesn't have a vax card. So you're imposing all these restrictions that's harming business, unemployment benefits, creating labor shortages. Just about every company that was missing from FedEx to KB Homes mentioned higher labor costs, not being able to find enough workers, having to bid up wages, having to give incentives to attract people. If we look at the energy front, we're reducing drilling. We basically stopped the pipeline, Keystone Pipeline. It's more expensive to transport oil by train or truck than it is a pipeline. So what are we saying? Gas prices are up almost $1 over the last year here in California. Northern California, Chris, they're already up over $6. And when you take a look at this longer term, debt is now growing at three times the rate of economic growth. So when you have that, you know, basically you're heading yourself into a crisis. And in this bill, they want to add three new benefits to Medicare, which would be dental, hearing, and basically eyesight, which is great. I mean, everybody's thinking, well, three new benefits. Who wouldn't want that? Well, that's going to cost money. The other thing they want to do is lower Medicare age to 62 and make it more available to other people. If they do that, the problem is the trustees of Medicare say the trust fund runs out of money in 2026. And we just interviewed Professor Manel from Boston University, and she's on the Social Security panel, and she's talking about, you know, Social Security is going to be in trouble in 2033, and it's not just COVID, but by then, they will only be able to pay out about 74% of benefits. So when you have a system that is heading for bankruptcy, why are you going to overload it with more benefits and add more people to it when the system is in trouble already? So there's that. Then on top of that, the budget deficits, and this goes all the way back to Trump. Remember, Trump was running trillion-dollar deficits in peacetime and an economic expansion. Well, we're in an economic expansion, and the deficit this year could be anywhere from $3 to $4 trillion, depending on, you know, what gets passed here. So what that means, as the Fed raises interest rates, the rate at which the government pays interest is somewhere around 2%. A 1% increase in interest rates on $30 trillion in debt is an additional $300 billion in interest. If we normalize and even get interest rates up by 2 percentage points or 3, you could be talking about $1 trillion of additional interest expense. Right now, interest expense makes up 10% of the government's budget. We are adding so much debt right now that we're heading for a dollar crisis. And as former Secretary of the Treasury Lawrence Summers said, you know, the only way you're going to get out of this is inflate. And the unfortunate thing about taxes, Chris, the cruelest form of taxation is inflation, because it hits the poor and the middle class the hardest. I mean, if your gas prices went up a buck and you're paying 20 bucks more for gas, your utilities have gone up, your food prices have gone up, you can't go to your boss and say, hey, my gas prices went up 20 bucks. I need 20 bucks more a week after taxes. It just doesn't work that way. So all of this is converging at the same time to create the perfect storm. Taxes, inflation, and bad legislation, the next perfect storm.
So as you said, Jim, no choice, and this is what Larry Summers is now saying as well as many other people lining up on the side, that there's really no choice at this point but to inflate away these high debts by allowing inflation to rise higher than interest rates. So financial repression will be something that will be implemented. This is something we've discussed in the past many times, and we'll likely be picking up this topic again in the future. And obviously, this has clear implications for the way that you invest.
Absolutely. And we're going to be talking about how to invest in this, because there's some great opportunities right now that the markets aren't aware of, especially when it comes to commodities, green metals, the essential metals for the green economy. And we'll be talking more about that in the future.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says contact us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.